After delving into the tragedies of the New Society of Red China with her 2011 very dark novel, Dreams of Joy, the sequel to her best-selling Shanghai Girls, Lisa C. decided she needed some song and dance in her life, so she started researching the so-called chop suey circuit in the decades surrounding World War II. Interviews with surviving entertainers of that tumultuous time not only helped her with her 2014 novel, China Dolls, but it captured a piece of American history for the families themselves.
Sometimes if you're an outside person, people will share stories with you that they might not tell their children or their grandchildren.
Discover some of these stories as Lisa C. reads from China Dolls and talks about the overt racism of that era on New Letters on the Air, a production of New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam, and we'll begin with Lisa C. setting the scene for her fictional book, China Dolls.
Three young women meet at an audition at the Forbidden City nightclub, which was the most famous of the Chinese-American nightclubs in San Francisco, Chinatown, in 1938. This was the height of the nightclub era all across the country, and these particular nightclubs, they featured performers who were billed as the Chinese Frank Sinatra, the Chinese Ginger Rogers, the Chinese Houdini, the Chinese Sally Rand, the Chinese fill-in-the-blank. So then when they would travel around the country going to other nightclubs, you didn't say we're going out on the Borscht Belt or we're going out on the Chitlin Circuit. You'd say we're going out on the Chop Suey Circuit. And people went all around the country playing different clubs.
And the China Dolls, they're girls when they meet,
really. They are. The youngest is 17, and that's Grace. She's run away from home. She grew up in Plain City, Ohio, where she's the only daughter of the only Chinese family in town. And actually, she's the most accurate to the performers of that era. Many of them, men and women, had grown up in small towns in the middle of the country where they were part of the only Chinese family for maybe 100 square miles. So already they had families that had broken the mold, you know,
right,
left a Chinatown, San Francisco, New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, to go to a place where they were completely cut off from Chinese culture, traditions, customs. And so those young women and boys grew up thinking that they could do whatever they wanted. They believed that they were American first. And certainly for little girls in that era, what you really wanted to be was Shirley Temple. And so Grace has learned how to tap dance and sing, and she runs away and goes to San Francisco. And then the next one, Helen, she's grown up in a very traditional Chinese compound right in the heart of San Francisco, Chinatown. In those days, you know, if you were a young woman in a Chinatown, you weren't allowed to show your bare arms and legs in public. You were supposed to stay home and learn to cook and embroider and take care of children and be a good wife. And so I thought, well, what would it have taken for a family to allow their daughter to dance? What could have been done to her, or what could she have done? Because actually, she is truly a fictional character. I didn't find a single performer who came out of a Chinatown.
Oh, so she was totally,
totally fictional.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the last one is Ruby.
And that's part of what gets unfurled as the novel goes along.
Right. And they all have secrets that unfurl. And then the last one is Ruby, and she is Japanese masquerading as Chinese. And she is modeled on several actual performers who did this. One of them, Dorothy Toy, who was the Chinese Ginger Rogers, what she said to me when I interviewed her, she was 93, she said, well, you know, Ethel Zimmerman looked at the marquee and thought her name looked too long and shortened it to Ethel Merman. And I looked at my name and thought it looked too long and shortened it to Dorothy Toy. So there's that kind of practical business reason, but there's another business reason, which is if you were Japanese or Filipino or one of these other categories, including someone from Portugal, you would change your name to sound Chinese so you could get a job in those clubs.
One of the things that I was delighted to see was that YouTube.
Oh, the clips. Aren't those wonderful?
The Toy and the Gingerbread.
Toy and Wing. That was
Toy and Wing, yes.
They're just wonderful. And there are other performers as well that you can find on YouTube. I've gathered them and put them on my website, so it's kind of like one-stop shopping, although you just click and you're back over to YouTube, but you don't have to search too much.
Right.
And I just think they're remarkable. One of my favorites is a woman singing to a sailor, and she's got this very saucy attitude, and it looks first like she's just a demure maiden, but she gets up and she sings, you know, very American-sounding, again, just playing with the stereotype of what a young Chinese woman would look like or act like. And the person she's singing to is a very young Cary Grant.
Oh, my goodness.
It must be one of his first roles. It's adorable. It's just really cute.
That's great. And your website is lisac.com, so people can go there and see that. I missed that it was a very young Cary Grant. Now I got to go back and look at that. I'm going to get you to read something from China Dolls. I've got a piece mark that's fairly early in the book that has the three characters together and gives us a sense of who they are. They've tried out for this nightclub, and only Grace and Helen have gotten in, and Ruby's kind of on the outside trying to make it with odd jobs, which becomes kind of a running joke in the beginning of this.
After rehearsal, we poured into the street. Fog draped heavy and white over the city, leaving the sidewalks eerily quiet. The melodies of chattering young girls sang through the night like police sirens. As the other ponies melted into the fog, Helen and I headed to Chinatown. For all of Mr. Fong's insistence that Helen always be escorted by her brother, the practice was haphazard at best. Ruby waited for us at Samwu, our favorite cafe. "I'm starved," she announced. That first night on the street outside the Forbidden City, something invisible but very strong had clicked between us like cogs catching and holding a tractor wheel. Now as we ate, we talked about insignificant things. "The hair on the left side of my head is fine and won't hold a curl," Ruby revealed. "That's why I pinned gardenias over that ear." "My feet are too long," Helen complained, even though they were smaller than Ruby's or mine. I told them my bosoms were growing too big, to which Ruby agreed, saying, "They're whopping for a Chinese girl." We ate. I was now adept at using chopsticks and laughed as Ruby told us about her latest job. "I don't know anything about housekeeping," she chirped. "The apartment was so nice I was afraid to touch anything. The lady released me, and after only one day. But that wasn't a good position for me because I'm not neat and I can barely wash a plate." We never talked about deep things, why I'd run away, how scared Helen must have been when the Japanese pilot tried to shoot her, or when Ruby had made up her mind to pretend she was something she wasn't. Instead, Ruby taught Helen and me how to hula, Helen taught Ruby and me how to make simple soups on our hot plate, and I taught them things I'd learned from the movies, like how to use makeup to make our eyes look more dramatic. Ruby and I had to watch our money, so we showed Helen how to make false eyelashes by taking strands of hair from our brushes, winding them around our fingers, snipping them with scissors, and gluing them onto strips, which we then applied to our eyelids. We copied my favorite actresses' hairdos and the way they plucked their eyebrows. We didn't spend a cent, but along the way, we fell in love with each other. The show kids said we went together like ginger, scallions, and garlic. Put us in a pot, and you get the perfect dish.
That's just a little bit from China Dolls, the novel by Lisa C. And it, just in that little scene, kind of introduces us to the three main characters. But what I like about this novel, and I wondered why you decided to do this particular scene is told from Grace's point of view, and you switch around all through the novel. We go between these three girls who become women, and we watch them evolve. What made you decide to tell the story from all three perspectives like that?
I actually wrote the entire novel, the first draft, from Grace's perspective. And I do write from beginning to end. I don't go back and edit. But there were places along the way where I could feel Helen and Ruby just trying to elbow their way in, you know, that they had things they wanted to say and Grace just couldn't say it for them. And so when I got to the end, and then I, you know, start over again at page one, I looked at those places where I could just hear Helen and Ruby, especially. Ruby just needs to be heard. And so whenever that happened, then I just basically rewrote the entire chapter. Some of what happens was from the original, but basically just rewriting it completely so that those other two women could have their voices.
And their voices are so different. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think you did a good job of capturing mm-hmm. that because their personalities are so different.
Yes. For example, with Ruby, she's Japanese American, but she's lived in different towns or cities that have had naval bases. She doesn't swear, but she has a lot of lingo that's very contemporary.
She's got all this jargon.
Just a funny way of looking at the world that's unlike any character that I've written before. And then with Helen, I did something that I've never done before, which is I do use a lot of aphorisms.
Right. And I noticed that in your work. You cannot refuse to eat just because there's a chance of being choked. Mm-hmm. I mean, things like this get speckled throughout. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I've collected a lot of them over the years. I've got notebooks that I've filled with them. And I actually, every chapter for Helen, I started with an aphorism that whether it was in the first paragraph or the first couple of pages, that was what I wanted emotionally for her. And that really helped to put me in her mindset of how she views the world. And she really did view the world through this very traditional Chinese lens. And then, of course, so much of that comes out of the language and the sentiments of traditional aphorisms.
I like that. And it seemed like there were more aphorisms as the book went on coming from her, as she became in some ways more entrenched.
Mm-hmm. I think as they grow up, you know, so it's 10 years. So they're going from, well, Grace starts, she's 17, so 17 to 27. And I think at the end, Helen is 30. And if you believe, as I actually do, that we just become more and more who we are, the older that we get, and we tend to become a little more entrenched the older that we get. And if we've been raised sometimes in a very conservative way, then we tend to become even more conservative. You know, all of that stuff that maybe we might have rebelled against a little bit when we were teenagers, it really comes back full circle, especially when we get married, when we have children, how you want to pass that on to them. You know, to me, that made a lot of sense, especially for Helen.
How many drafts do you feel that you go through? Does it vary from book to book?
This book was a lot of drafts. Maybe 15.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, total. I mean, maybe I got to 6 before I turned it in, and then we had a lot of different ideas about where the story should go or what I should do, and then I had ideas also of things I wanted to change the longer I spent with it. And, you know, things become clearer the longer you live with something. And there are times when I'll just wake up in the middle of the night or I'll wake up first thing in the morning and I'll think, oh, now I know what should happen. Now it's so clear to me what should actually be happening or how someone would respond in this situation. The longer I think I spend with characters, the clearer they become to me.
I'm just amazed at the variety of stories that you come up with to pursue. And usually they have some real life moment in history that you springboard off of. Mm-hmm. And like you said, Helen was completely out of your imagination and not based on anyone. But what was at the heart of China Dolls that made you want to write a novel about this particular thing?
Dreams of Joy, the previous novel, was pretty dark. It takes place during the Great Leap Forward in China. It's a story of a mother and a daughter and what happens to them there. Both, you know, have lived here in America for a long time, but make the bad mistake of going back to China at just the exact wrong time. And during the Great Leap Forward, 45 million people starved to death.
It was such a tragic time.
Terrible any way you look at it.
Right.
And I lived in that for a couple of years, and it was very dark. And I do write novels that are sad, and sad things happen, no question. But that may have been the hardest, just because it was really unrelentingly dark, That doesn't mean people shouldn't read it. But it does have a happy ending.
Right.
It was hard for me. And at the end, I can remember I was just sort of sprawled out on the couch, just like, oh, my God, that was hard. And I love Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies. I love them. And I was watching them sort of as a cure. There was something about watching those movies right then that made me feel, and I think like so many young people did back in the old days, but even today, where I wish I could live in that. I wish I could be in that scene. I wish I could be in that movie. I wish I could be up there on the screen. And I think that that's one of the things that propelled so many of these performers in the 20s and 30s and 40s, but it continues to do it today. And so that sense, that sort of, if only I could be in that, and I knew where and how I could be in it, was to immerse myself in that world and be with characters who yearned to be in the movie in that scene.
And you needed a little song and dance.
I needed it. I did. Yeah. I really did.
I'm Angela Elam talking with Lisa C. today for New Letters on the Air. For people who don't know you, and we talked about this some in our earlier conversation back in 2007, but your background is part Chinese.
Right.
And when you look at you,
you wouldn't know anything about it. No, I have red hair and freckles for the people who are listening. So I don't look at all Chinese. But I come from a very large Chinese-American family in Los Angeles. I have about 400 relatives. There are about a dozen that look like me. The majority are still full Chinese, and then this little spectrum in between.
I couldn't help but think, especially in reading China Dolls, your most recent book, that this book is different in the sense you've dealt with so many Chinese themes all along because you grew up in Chinatown, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. But in China Dolls, you also take on the racism that's towards Japanese Americans. And your main characters are still Chinese for the most part.
Right.
And it made me realize that you were really approaching racism from a lot of different vantage points in this mm-hmm. book. Can mm-hmm. you talk a little bit about that?
The subject of racism is really a deep theme throughout the book. And I think you're right that I am looking at it from different perspectives of what it was like for these performers working in a club where they're kind of exoticized in a sense, and that audience that comes to see them, a white audience, is looking at them and really having their preconceptions and misconceptions blown, in a sense, that some of the stereotypes in those days about Asians were things like they can't dance, they have bow legs, they have no sense of humor. And so to see dancing girls in top hats and stylized tuxedos and fishnet stockings and high heels was just beyond anything the audience could really even take in. You know, it just really changed the perspective. And then between the Chinese and the Japanese, you know, Japan had already invaded China. This is the Sino-Japanese War, which will eventually roll right into World War II. So the animosity between those two countries and people who were Chinese and Japanese Americans, that already existed even before Pearl Harbor. And then once Pearl Harbor happens, this old discrimination and racism that had been targeted at the Chinese that had come out of the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882 now switched to Japanese Americans, which leads to internment. So I really am looking at it from a lot of different angles and looking at some of the miscegenation laws. You know, 28 states had miscegenation laws. In California, ours was overturned in 1948, in Washington state not till 1965.
You know, it's so interesting because I knew about the miscegenation laws with African-American right. and white Americans, but I did not know about it until I read your book, mm-hmm. that it also pertained to crossing between any race. It's such a strong story in that you bring in so many of these conflicts that are going on in the world. One of the things that you display in this novel, China Dolls, is the internment camps, because one of the characters ends up in one of these camps. And we also see how Japanese Americans, they're inscripted, they end up fighting, but they're also discriminated against for being Japanese. And so I wanted to have you read one of these places that I marked in here dealing with racism.
Mm-hmm.
This is right after Pearl Harbor. And Joe is Occidental. And yeah, which is a phrase. I mean, he's one of the white guys.
I can write that, but I sure don't like to say it.
Right, exactly. But it's not all Chinese and Japanese. It really does showcase our culture, mm-hmm. our American
yes,
culture.
Yes, he's from Winnetka, Illinois. You know, the very first time I went to Winnetka to give a talk, the bookseller drove me around the town and drove me around the neighborhood. And it was just so different from anything I've ever experienced, certainly in Southern California, the neighborhood and how sort of solid and permanent it felt. And so when I wanted to have a character for China Dolls, I knew he had to be from Winnetka. So here we go. 10 days after the attack on Pearl Harbor, Joe brought issues of Time and Life to our apartment. Here, at last, was information we believed we could trust, but oh, brother. The magazines offered diagrams and photos titled How to Tell Japs from the Chinese and How to Tell Your Friends from the Japs. Life encouraged its readers to overcome their, quote, distressing ignorance on this delicate question. So, Chinese were tall, averaging 5'5", while Japs topped out at 5'2.5". Chinese tended to put on weight to show they were prosperous, while Japs were seldom fat, except for sumo wrestlers. Chinese were not hairy, while Japs could grow mustaches. After decades of being labeled inscrutable, suddenly Chinese could be identified by their placid, kindly, and open expressions, while anyone, armed with the information provided in the magazine's pages, should be able to spot a Jap by his dogmatic assertions, his insistence on pushing his arrogance in your face, and the way he could be counted on to laugh loudly at the wrong time. It says here that Chinese have parchment yellow complexions, Ruby relayed to Joe, while Japs have earthy yellow complexions. Japs also have flat noses, massive cheek and jawbones, and short faces. That stuff was nonsense. But to hear Ruby read those things aloud, it was chilling. I caught her eye. When I saw nothing there, I understood the absolute terror she must have been feeling. It all made me ill. The lie itself, the disquieting apprehension of what would happen if her secret were revealed, and the concern over what Joe, our friend, for heaven's sake, would do if and when he found out. As Christmas approached, the phone company ran ads. Long distance helps unite the nation, and promised to use every circuit and every operator on Christmas Eve and Christmas Day. I wanted Mom to know I was safe. I wanted to hear her say, "We're fine too. We love you, honey." But a part of me was so terrified my father might answer the phone. What if he didn't let me speak to her, that I didn't even try to put through a call? I hated myself for being such a coward, so on some nights I, too, cried alone in my room. At the end of January, the Justice Department announced that all strategic locations, which included San Francisco, needed to be cleared of enemy aliens. On February 2nd, registration would begin. Ruby didn't seem concerned. I'm not an enemy alien. I was born here, and I'm an American citizen. I was scared for her.
That's Lisa C. reading a little bit from her novel, China Dolls. This is New Letters on the Air.
It's hard for me to read that out loud. That was a very hard thing with this novel, because there's a lot of stuff that today it's politically incorrect.
Right.
It's very upsetting just now to read that, but it's of the time.
Right. And to not use it wouldn't be authentic.
No,
I
it would
think.
Not have been authentic at all. And
yeah.
Isn't it amazing that Time and Life magazines had articles like that? Those articles ran simultaneously 2 weeks after Pearl Harbor. And they had these arrows, you know, it was a diagram with these arrows pointing at different parts of the body. Just unbelievable, because you couldn't imagine today a mainstream newspaper or magazine putting anything like that in their pages.
That is pretty distressing.
That one decade, it doesn't have zeros on the end, but 1938, 1948, the Depression, World War II, and the introduction of television and an adoption of television in a big way into our homes. So in that one decade, we change how we look at each other. We change how we look at the outside world. We change how we dress, what we eat. We change how we spend time with our families, how we spend our entertainment, our free time. And in that is how we look at each other. And it really is a transformative moment for our country. And a lot of it has to do with World War II and men going to the Pacific Theater or to the European Theater or into North Africa, but also
the woman's role in our society.
The woman's role in our society and Rosie the Riveter, but also those men, not only are they seeing different people and different cultures out there in the war, they're also fighting side by side with people that they may not have ever met in their hometowns or ever had any contact with in their hometowns. And these are people that are putting their lives in each other's hands. And that really leads to so many changes for us. It takes a while. You know, it doesn't happen overnight. But that is really significant and fits again into this whole question of race and racism and discrimination and how it starts to change and really evolve during that particular decade.
I wondered, you know, being someone who looks like an outsider within your Chinese part of your family, do you think that gives you a particular sensitivity? Because, I mean, have you ever felt discrimination because you look more like your Irish side of the family than your Chinese side?
I think it sort of goes a little of both ways. I think on the one hand, I mean, I remember with On Gold Mountain, my first book, which is about my family, and I interviewed so many family members. And at the end, sometimes one of my relatives would say to me, you know, oh, you know, you should go talk to so-and-so. You know, he's white like you. And I had never realized that my own family saw me as different. And yet I know every inch of Los Angeles Chinatown. I'm very comfortable in China. To me, it's just sort of a bigger version of Chinatown. But now with the success of these books, I've traveled around the country much more than I ever had. And I often go places where I look like I belong. And so I think people sometimes talk to me like I belong and like I'm in the know, but I'm not in that know. And so it's interesting. I'm not completely in this and I'm not completely in that. And I think you're right that that sense of not being completely here and not being completely there, that's the place that I'm writing from.
You know, all the books that you write are actually at a pivotal time in history. Mm-hmm. Are you looking for that, or is it just your own curiosity? I want to explore that world, or is it a combination?
There are things that I come across where I think this would be something great, but I think about it for a long time. I think even just talking about China Dolls, you could see I'd been thinking about it for a very long time before there was a moment where I thought, okay, this is the time. And part of that is because I really do, you know, invest a lot of time once I decide in the research. And I feel it's sort of like a marriage. You know, we're in it for the long term together. This isn't a one-night stand. We're going to be in this for a long, long time. So it better be something I really care about and passionate about.
Lisa C., in 2014, after the release of her novel China Dolls, now available in paperback, for links to her novels mentioned today and to our previous interviews about her earlier books, visit our website, newletters.org. While you're there, sign up for our free podcast under Ways to Listen or on iTunes. Follow us on Facebook, Tumblr, and Twitter at New Letters Radio. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters Magazine, published by the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with partial financial support from the Missouri Arts Council, a state agency. Today's show was produced with help from Jamie Walsh, Brittany Green, Timothy Larrison, and Coy Duggar. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.